Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to Memorial Day. We have a treat for you this morning. I couldn't think of a better grand finale speaker. It's Professor Derek Booth. He's a professor here in civil and environmental engineering and Department for Earth and Space Sciences. He now works with Stillwater Sciences and he holds adjunct positions here at UW. And this water center, the success of the center over the last 10, 15 years is thanks to Derek. Derek was the director of the water center for more than 10 years and he really developed that work and built it up to what it is today. So we really have Derek to thank for that. He's got a fabulous range of experience. He's an internationally known expert on river processes, on urban or stormwater management, urban water management. He received his bachelor's degree in literature, and that's why he writes so beautifully, from Hampshire College. He also received a bachelor's degree in geology from UC Berkeley. He received his master's degree in geology from Stanford, and he received his PhD from the University of Washington in Geological Sciences. And he's going to be a fascinating talk. I'm looking forward to this on the Tale of Two Rivers. Let's offer a warm welcome to Derek Booth.
Well, thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here. I thought it's the last talk of the quarter. I thought I'd tell a story today. It will be an audio and visual and video, if you will. And because it's a story, I'm not going to give you the punchline until we get to the end. You'll actually have to make up your own mind whether there is a punchline. But for me, the value of looking at different places, and in particular different rivers, is that you learn things about both by the comparison that you would not have necessarily learned or perhaps wouldn't have even thought of without that comparison. So without further ado, we will just wander forward. So where is Tiger Mountain and Topa Topa Bluff? Tiger Mountain is actually our very own Tiger Mountain. It's about 30 miles east of here. And the river in question is Issaquah Creek. Topa Topa Bluff is down in Southern California. And the river in question is Santa Paula Creek. They're both roughly the same watershed area, and we'll develop other comparisons and differences between them as we go along. And you see, on a hemispheric scale, they're not that far apart. But certainly conditions in Washington and conditions in California are at least somewhat different. And so hopefully you'll get a flavor of that. So let's start with a little overview of Issaquah Creek. I've circled the Issaquah Creek watershed there. You see the purple and gold where we are this morning. It forms the head of the Sammamish watershed. It's about 56 square miles. This is a little bit closer view of it. And you'll see, you'll see Tiger Mountain up there on the right, which is the high point of the, that is quite a nice one, the high point of the watershed. And there are a number of tributaries. Eventually the river comes out into Lake Sammamish. This is a map. It's lacking the watershed outline, but it's basically the same area, and it highlights some of the major tributaries that feed into the main stem of Issaquah Creek, which runs through downtown Issaquah on out into Lake Sammamish. So just a little pictorial stroll down Issaquah Creek, looking at some of the tributary watersheds of it. This is the East Fork, up pretty high. This is the East Fork as it goes by the Dairy Gold milk packing factory in Issaquah. This is 15 Mile Creek. Holder Creek, one of the two major upland tributaries actually that drains Tiger Mountain. And the main stem, Issaquah Creek, on a typical day in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, and this is the Google Earth view of the watershed. We're hovering over Lake Sammamish. The river is right out here. This is all delta of Issaquah Creek, Interstate 90, heading on up toward the pass. The main stem actually passes through here and then drains the backside of Tiger Mountain, and this
broad upland area, not when you're hanging out there in the background.
How many people have been to Issaquah Creek or been to... Okay, great. So you got a feel for it. That's good. And this is a profile that generated just off Topo, that map routine. Basically, the river or the watershed spans about 3,000 feet of relief, and it's a little hard to see from the back. It's actually a little hard to see right here on the screen. But we're looking at about 17 or 18 miles of river length from the very top of the watershed down to Lake Sammamish. Okay, now let's head south. We're in Southern California. We have the San Andreas Fault, major plate boundary coming through here. We actually have the Garlock Fault, a cross-cutting that kind of puts a funny bend in the motion of the plates in this part of the world. Just to get you a little more located, Santa Barbara is sitting out here. Los Angeles sits in here. What else do we have? Central Valley here, San Francisco Bay there. Okay, got it? How many people have been to sort of the greater Santa Barbara Ventura region? Oh, fabulous. So you know what that looks like, too. For those of you who haven't, it's a little drier down there. Very active tectonics, and we'll have more to say about that later, but just be aware that stuff is moving around out here pretty regularly. And in fact, it's moving around in such a way that in this particular area, it has a little, you know, when plates of the earth are sliding past each other, like when anything is sliding past each other, it kind of makes a straight line. And if something warps that line, which in this case is the Garlock Fault, the slipping doesn't work as easily, and material tends to pile up. And you may say to yourself, well, what does that have to do with the river? But hold that thought. So here we are at some of the watershed, just a little bit closer look. Here's the Los Angeles River, just to get you oriented a little bit more. The Santa Clara River is the main watershed of which Santa Paula Creek, which drains off of this area here where the star is one of the mid-sized tributaries. Its drainage area is about 45 square miles, so it's a little bit smaller than Issaquah Creek, but it's not too bad. It's not too different. Here's a very nicely colored, shaded relief of Santa Paula Creek. It has a few interesting features that were mainly of interest for a particular project that I and a number of others worked on down here, which was my first introduction to it. But here's the main stem of Santa Paula. It heads up in this direction, heads up into this area. We have another tributary that comes in here. There are a couple of highway crossings, a couple in particular right here. There's a diversion dam that we'll take a look at in a little bit that was actually the reason for working here. And then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has had a long history of mucking about in the channel. And just as the town of Issaquah sits adjacent to the lower reaches of Issaquah Creek, so the town of Santa Paula sits adjacent to the lower reaches of Santa Paula Creek. So here's a few views of Santa Paula Creek, just to give you a flavor. You notice the vegetation's a little different from Issaquah Creek. You also notice that at least here and there, and this is one of them, there's bedrock exposed along the margins. Here's another view of it. You might start to admire the size of some of the gravel class, boulder class, that are being transported by this flow. Here's a view. We're actually at the edge. This is the downstream lip of that Harvey Diversion Dam. This is a tributary, aptly named Mud Creek. And then the flow continues on down, and this is some of the bedrock that's exposed along there. Here's some more views of the river. This is a little farther upstream. I'm not sure if there's a scale in this picture, but just to give you a flavor, this boulder here is probably
4 feet in diameter. This guy's probably
2 feet, you know, kind of like this. So we're upstream. We're you know, there's not 42 square miles of watershed behind this. There's maybe a third or a quarter of that. There's another boulder, sort of local art, Santa Paula style. But this is not a boulder that was transported by glaciers. This is a boulder that was transported by the stream channel, and it stands taller than I do, and probably than the rest of you, too. Okay, let's talk about geologic controls in these two different watersheds. You gather from my educational background, I'm a geologist by training, and so I'm always interested in understanding what is the geologic setting, what are the geologic processes that have given rise to the features that we see in any given watershed. So, here in this part of the world, it's all about glaciers. It's not all about, but it's mainly about glaciers. This is a map on the right of an artist's rendition, if you will, of what the last great ice sheet looked like that filled the Puget Lowlands, covered Seattle, Issaquah area up to a depth of about 1,000 meters in ice, so that's a little more than a half mile straight up in ice. It came down about 16,000 years ago. It only occupied this landscape for about 1,000 years, but it overrode pretty much everything, including Tiger Mountain. There was a lot of, the ice itself slid fairly rapidly for a glacier. It had a great deal of water underneath it, alongside it. So there's quite a bit of geomorphic work, a lot of sculpting of the landscape that occurred during this period. In particular, I'd like to call your attention to some of these major troughs of the lowland. This is in a color band shaded digital elevation model. Here's Lake Sammamish in here. So this is the Issaquah Creek watershed, kind of up in here. This is what today's pattern looks like, and it looks, you know, the margin of the ice sheet is out here, and so it kind of looks skewed, like all the watery stuff is out here to the left. But in fact, if you reconstruct this and say, well, let's put it back the way it would have been at the end of glaciation, because remember, in the last 15,000 years since the ice sheet departed, Mount Rainier has been busy pumping out mud flows and eruptions from time to time. And so all of these troughs that used to be open water actually were filled in. So if we want to understand what the glacier did, we have to remove that fill of the post-glacial era. And now we get a pattern that looks much more symmetrical, and in fact it's a pattern that looks very much like what we would expect the subglacial flow of water and ice to be like as it sculpts the landscape. And the reason I'm putting this up is that the focus of our interest today, namely the Issaquah watershed, is exactly a product of, or has been strongly influenced by, that glacial movement. And so that's kind of our story here in Issaquah. In addition, one other factor that's worth mentioning, although I don't think I put a slide in of it, is that the Seattle Fault, how many people have heard of the Seattle Fault? It's good, the rest of you should learn about it, you're living on it, it could be really bad news if it went off, comes across here pretty much east-west. It does go right through the middle of Seattle. That's why it's good to know about it. It's been active for probably 10 or more million years. It lifts things up on the south side relative to the north side. And in fact, these bedrock highs, including Tiger Mountain, have been lifted up by movement on the Seattle Fault. Rates are kind of hard to tell. We had an event that uplifted the south side about 8 meters relative to the north. 1,000 years ago, we may have had one or two of those episodes since the last glacial period. And so we're coming up over here, but we're coming up on the order of a meter per 1,000 years, maybe. Probably not even that fast, and very episodic, very irregularly. Probably closer to half a meter per 1,000 years, spread out over a long period of time. Okay. On the other hand, now we're going down to California. Somebody added that little arrow, which I think is kind of cute. We are looking at, if you will, a diagrammatic block cutout of the landscape around the Santa Paula Creek watershed. And the major feature here is this fault through here. It's called the San Cayetano Fault. This stuff up here, which are older rocks, Eocene means like 40 million years ago. Pleistocene, that means like the last 2 million years. So those of you who have even taken one geology course should be thinking something like, wait a minute, how come you have older stuff that's 40 million years sitting on top of younger stuff that's only 2 million years, right? It's supposed to be the other way around. So there's a clue that there's been a lot of crustal motion. In addition, you'll notice that the bedding here of these 2 million year old rocks, which 2 million years is very young in the world of rocks, just by the way, these things were already standing up vertically. In fact, in some areas, they've gone past vertical and have already flipped and are overturned. That is a really fast rate of deposition, rate of deformation. Today, by various techniques, we estimate that the rate of overall uplift of this upper block as it gets shoved up the ramp by virtue of, you know, movement of the plates swirling around the San Andreas fault bend is on the order of 1 to 2 millimeters per year as people reconstruct back half a million or a million years. That rate may have even been double. So we're talking about uplift rates that are 2 to 5 to 10 times greater than anything that we see up here in western Washington. We do not have glaciers down here. So in this part of the world, the story is the tectonic deformation as the geologic context. Here's a little segment of the geologic map for this area, just to give you a flavor of it. This is, we're kind of right in the middle of the watershed. Here's Santa Paula Creek heading on up toward Topatopa Ridge, which is up about here. Here's that side tributary. Here's the maps, these heavy dashed lines, the map strands of the San Cayetano Fault, and this is known as the Sisar Fault. Where did the Sisar Fault go along through here? The point is, there's a lot of breakage in the rocks, and in general, this stuff is going up, and it's going up fast. This stuff is either going down, or at least it's not moving. So think about a watershed where the upper half of it is really getting jacked up, and hold that thought. But you can look at some consequences of it. These are some strata. This is some of those 2 million year old strata that are already tipped up to nearly vertical, and you can kind of see them bent over. I don't know, those of you who are geologists really, I mean, this is cool stuff. This is a Google Earth rendering. Santa Paula Creek is coming out this way and heading on out. The Sisar San Cayetano Fault cuts across here. And take a look over in this area. What you see there are surfaces of flat terraces that used to be floodplains of the creek. And so what's happening is that we're basically uplifting the upper watershed above the fault so rapidly that the channel is cutting down and is not yet sort of meandered back and forth to consume it. So these are actually relic floodplains, and you can see them scattered across the landscape. But instead of being a few feet above the river channel, they are, in some cases, hundreds of feet above the river channel. People have gone out and dated these surfaces, and it's from those kinds of data that we're able to estimate the rate of uplift, because the datable material in here are typically organics associated with floodplain material, floodplain vegetation. So we see when these things were adjacent to the river, acting as part of its floodplain.
We now observe them hundreds of feet above and can get an average rate of uplift from that. It's very rapid. Okay, so back to the Issaquah Creek profile, and we can superimpose at pretty much the same scale the Santa Paula Creek profile. It's a lot steeper. There's a lot more relief, nearly double the relief. And it's a consequence of the rate of uplift going on in the northern upper half of the watershed. So you should begin to think in your mind, okay, to what degree is this likely to affect or change the behavior of the one channel relative to the other? And this is a view, another Google Earth view of the Santa Paula Creek watershed. Here's where it comes down and meets the Santa Clara River. Here's the town of Santa Paula. There's a telephone call. This is the fan, sort of the equivalent location of where the town of Issaquah sits. And then the watershed heads back up, but it really climbs steeply. And again, the faults are coming across about here. Okay, next contrast is rainfall. Okay, things are different. And indeed, the precipitation regime, the total rainfall, is really, really different between these places. Issaquah gets about three times, actually more like 3.5 times, the annual rainfall of Ventura, which is the closest gauge to Santa Paula. And you can see also the distribution. You know, we all have the same style of rainfall, right? It doesn't rain in the summertime. Although you'll notice if you live in Southern California, it really doesn't rain in the summertime. And it gets wetter in November and December and January and February. It's just that around here, it kind of gives it up a lot more begrudgingly, and it never really bottoms out. But part of this story is also not just the total monthly or annual average amounts, but kind of typical recurrences. So I want to take you through a couple of rainfall recurrence maps. These are all from the National Weather Service, and I'll show you how to read these. These are isopluvials, in other words, contours of equal rainfall. They are in tenths of an inch. So 35 is 3.5 inches. And they're different maps for different areas. In fact, the entire West Coast is covered by these maps. And they're all determined by the recurrence and the duration of a given storm. So the two-year 24-hour storm is the total amount of rain that you would expect to collect over a 24-hour period that would be equal to or exceeded about every other year. I mean, not necessarily odd years versus even years, but if you had a record of 50 years, you'd expect about 25 of those years to have as its maximum rainfall accumulation over 24 hours, you know, about a 3 to 5 inch range in this area. Now, what I've circled here is the area of the Issaquah Creek watershed, and you can see that down here in the town of Issaquah, we get about 3 inches in the two-year 24-hour storm, and up here on Tiger Mountain, we get about 5 inches over a two-year storm over 24 hours. Okay, everybody happy with that? Okay, let's look now at the 100-year 24-hour storm. This would be the rainfall total that we would expect to be equal or exceeded only about once a century. So much less frequent, therefore the totals are much higher. Down here in Issaquah, you'd expect to see about 5 inches of rain, and up on Tiger Mountain, you'd expect to see about 9 inches of rain. Okay, that's wet. So now let's go down to California, where of course it's much drier, it doesn't rain very much, and let's look at the same totals. Of course, you're getting set up for this, right? Here's the two-year 24-hour storm. The circle is circling the Santa Paula watershed. Same orographic effect, so down here at low elevations, we're seeing in the town of Santa Paula about 3 inches of rain. Up here on Topatopa Ridge, About 6 inches. So actually, this is not too different from Issaquah. So once again, which is kind of odd in some ways, because after all, it only gets about a third of the annual total. But clearly, when it comes in a couple of pretty strong bursts. The really remarkable comparison is with the 100-year 24-hour storm. We're down here in the valley. We're still seeing 9 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. And up here on the ridge, we're seeing twice as much, 18 inches, a foot and a half of rain in 24 hours. You compare this with Issaquah, you can see that the 100-year storm, in other words, the rare extreme event, is something like double what we expect to see up here. And that is a fairly significant climatological difference. It's an extreme event, so you wouldn't expect to see that difference expressed every year or every other year or even every decade. But as we look to more and more infrequent, larger events, the difference between these climatic regimes gets greater and greater. Everything's pretty mellow up here, right? And down in California, it's really dry except when it's really wet. And then it gets really wet. So here's a little quote from the Western Regional Climate Center. We are in the San Gabriel Mountains, just in case you were wondering. We're at the west edge of the San Gabriel Mountains. Maximum intensity are greater than anywhere else in the continental United States. So this is, and it also has, just hearkening back about 10 minutes, it also has some of the most rapid rates of tectonic uplift anywhere in the continental United States. So hold those two stories together. I'm afraid they never say those kind of things about the Pacific Northwest, except, you know, we have some of the most even rainfall. We have some of the most quiescent topography. I guess Kansas is flatter. But so let's see how all this goes together. Back to rainfall. This is the USGS gauge. In the town of Issaquah, right at the Southeast 56th Street Bridge, maximum discharge, about 3,300 CFS back here. I think that was 1990. Anybody here in 1990? Not very many. A good part of, I don't know how many of you have gone like shopping in those malls south of town in Issaquah. There were cars in the parking lot with water up to here for 3 days. It was really quite exciting. I worked for the county at the time, so I had the opportunity to see a lot of them. But I didn't have a chance to scan those slides to give you a few pictures of them here today. If we shoot down to Santa Paula Creek, remember this is 56 square miles, so now we're going to go look at Santa Paula Creek, 45 square miles. This is what it looks like. Take a look at the scale over here. And remember that Issaquah Creek is down there. This is a watershed that's 10 to 15% smaller than Issaquah Creek. It has less than a third of the average annual rainfall, and yet it's got some pretty serious flows. This is about 27,000 cubic feet per second. That's nearly an order of magnitude larger. And in case you're curious what this looks like, it only happened a couple years ago. It was 2005. Oh, let me just show you a few more data. This is the flood frequency table for Santa Paula Creek. So that 27,000 CFS discharge was somewhere around a 40 to 50 year event. By comparison, here's Issaquah Creek's peak discharge. Over 42 years of record, I think it was estimated to be about a 50 or 60 year event. It isn't even equivalent to a 5 year discharge. So in 100 years, you might expect 20 discharges like this. At Issaquah Creek, you might expect one or two of them. And then the one that we actually saw was right in here, about 50 over that period of record. It just happened 2 years ago. There's another interesting consequence of that, which I think we have time to look at. How many of you have taken like some course or some familiarity in fluvial geomorphology, or geomorphology of any kind? Anything?
Okay, there are a few. So for the few of you, this will be useful. For the rest of you, live and learn. Consider the flow in a river and ask yourself, how much sediment will that flow transport? And I hope it's intuitive to you that if the flow goes up, you can transport more sediment, right? It's easy enough. That's this red curve. And we're not going to worry about the shape of it or the details. It differs for every river. But clearly, more water, that would be going this way on the graph, more sediment transport, right? Easy. All right. Now, if you look at the distribution of flows in a river, you know, the flows go up, the flows go down. Every now and then you get a really big flow. Every now and then you get a really little flow. But most of the time the flows are kind of hanging out somewhere in the middle. That's this curve. And it says we don't see big flows very often. In at least a perennial stream, we don't see really little flows very often. But we kind of see a bunch of intermediate ones. And sometimes we get moderate storms, but they don't happen very often either. Okay? Everybody happy with that? So if you were going to ask the question, how much sediment does this river transport over time? It would be some kind of combination of how long it hangs out at any given discharge and how much sediment it's transporting while it's hanging out at that discharge. You need to add them up over all the discharges. So that's basically the product of this curve with this curve. And at least diagrammatically, it's a curve that typically looks like this. In other words, at low discharges, even though you may spend a fair amount of time in that phase, you don't move very much sediment, so you don't move all that much in aggregate. Way out here, boy, you can transport a whole lot of sediment, but you spend so little time there that, in fact, this curve tends to roll right over. And there's some intermediate discharge, which geomorphologists are very fond of identifying. It's called the effective discharge or the dominant discharge or terms like that. It's supposed to be the discharge that moves the most sediment over the long period of time. And we expect the channel to be sort of adjusted to be about the size that's needed to move that discharge. This is the classic view. If you ever do take a class in geomorphology, you will see this graph or something very close to it. And it's sort of the canon. It's the closest thing we have to a Bible. However, this was developed on well-behaved rivers in the Midwest, in the Pacific Northwest, in New England, and nobody had ventured down to sort of the wilds of Southern California, where, you know, it doesn't rain very much anyway. Who cares? But if we do a similar plot to this, it won't look quite the same graphically just because we didn't have the same imagery. But we have the same curves here. Here's the transport rate, that red curve, right, that just goes monotonically up. As the discharge increases, the sediment transport increases. Here's the flow frequency curve. But unlike the flow frequency curve for typical humid rivers, in Santa Paula Creek and other creeks like that there, yes, it kind of rolls over, but it has a much more extended tail, right? Because Santa Paula Creek, even though it's a little stream, can still generate flows that are 25,000 cubic feet per second. And when you multiply these two curves together, the blue one and the red one, just like in the last graph, it turns out that the product, the total sediment transported, it doesn't have any maximum. It just keeps going. And what that tells you is that if you get a big flow, it will do the most work over time. And in fact, the channel may never catch up with itself, if you will. A big flow, it doesn't heal, it doesn't recover, because no other flow comes close to having the same kind of influence on moving sediment, on eroding channel banks. And so it's a very different style of river. It's sort of a catastrophic system rather than an equilibrium system. And how that exactly translates into what we expect to see in the evolution of these channels, I don't think anybody knows, because nobody has looked very hard at these rivers. Everybody really much prefers the well-behaved ones. But I do want to show you what it looks like in the channel. So here's a view
once again, I think we actually saw this view before. This is the downstream end of the dam, named after Mr. Harvey. It's a diversion dam because they water avocado orchards with it. Here's Mud Creek coming in. The channel is heading on this way. And in 2005, that's what it looked like. This is from the other side of the river. This was not quite at the peak, but it was pretty close to the peak. The dam is somewhere in there. This is probably 15,000 CFS right now. Looking a little farther downstream, this was a fish ladder. And then looking downstream, this is the flow that is happily eroding as it goes. It eroded about 8 feet through bedrock in this one event on its way downstream. You see some of the boulders that have been left now stranded up on the terrace that used to be part of the floodplain. Here's a deposit from that 2005 channel. That backpack, you know, is this backpack. So these are big, and they're just kind of stacked up like cordwood. So that's what the flows will do. Now let's talk a little bit about the sediment that is produced, that is shed off the hillside, that these channels are able to transport, or that are made available to the channels for transport. So here we are up on Tiger Mountain, Boulder Creek coming down. So we'll start with the Issaquah Creek watershed, since after all that's what we're looking at here. Couple of different sediment production mechanisms. This is from a master's student of mine, Aaron Nelson, who did this work a couple of years ago, in an effort to actually quantify the average annual sediment yield being brought to the channel of Issaquah Creek and transported down to the mouth. The processes that she recognized were landslides, road surface erosion, channel bank erosion, and this was the net result of her work. I'm skipping over about 9 months in about 9 seconds. Total sediment production, about 6,400 metric tons per year, and if you scale that by the size of the watershed, it's about 50 tons per square mile of watershed area per year. Remember that number. Okay, and here's one last graph from her. Here's this study. This study is Issaquah Creek. So Issaquah Creek is not a particularly voluminous sediment producer. These are other forested watersheds, mainly watersheds undergoing active logging on steep, outrageously unstable slopes like we used to do around here. And in fact, this gave you an idea of the differences in sort of stable versus unstable locales. But you can kind of get a sense of a typical range of Pacific Northwest sediment yields, a couple of hundred tons per square kilometer per year. Okay, now let's go do the same exercise in Santa Paula Creek. We did a slightly different approach. We basically took the factors that we believe determine how productive or how rapidly sediment will be shed off of hillsides. Those factors are slope, the underlying geology, since if, for example, you're interested in sandstone, you need to have sandstone bedrock. If you're interested in fine sediment, you need to have a bedrock that will pass that fine sediment. And then the Quaternary deposits are the younger riverine deposits. And just one example, here's some of the fine-grained bedrock, and here's some of these Quaternary deposits that are now stranded. They used to be transported by the river, but they've now, because either the ground has been uplifted or the river has downcut, they're no longer accessed by the river. And then lastly, land cover. So slope, geology, and land cover. This is an automated classification, but it works pretty well. And in a GIS environment, it's possible to do things that we weren't able to do back in 1999 in terms of combining these and trying to understand how the different combinations, what those combinations look like on the ground and how they translate into sediment production rates. So we get what are called process domains, basically the unique combination of slope categories, geology categories, and land cover categories. And you get a fairly counterintuitive looking pattern on the map. And you say, what the heck can I do with this? But we can begin to break it down, as long as you go in the field and actually go and look at these things. And I want to just show you a few examples of that. So let's look at an area that has moderate slope, has sort of a scrubby land cover. I believe we're in the sandstone area. It looks like this. And you may not know what the number is for moderate, but you can see, I hope, that this is likely to be a landscape that definitely produces some sediment and sheds it down to the channel, but it's not raging, it's not raw, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute. A low sediment delivery down here, we're on a north slope, it develops forest cover, it's a little damper there, and hopefully you can look at this and say, yeah, I could see how this would probably produce less sediment over time, it would not be eroding as much. And hopefully if you look over here in a steep area with bare cover, you could say, yeah, I can imagine that this stuff would be shedding a lot of blocks of sandstone, which is the geology here. And similarly, if we look in an area where there is not sandstone but instead shale, you can see this kind of a look and say, yes, this looks like an area that is producing lots of sediment. So we attach numbers to those. We make these combinations. This is a view of sediment production across the entire watershed, just classified low, medium, high. We try and calibrate that with some available data. I'll show you just a view of what it looks like. Here's that high production zone in sandstone. You'll notice we have quite a bit less in terms of high production areas. There's not a lot of places that deliver the big sandstone blocks that wind up into the stream channel. And this is what they look like. The notebook is right here. It's six, you know, it's a regular field notebook. So this guy is about 20 feet high. And it just basically dropped off into the channel. The channel's going to have to work a little while to move this thing along. But it's already managing these 5-foot boulders no problem. So the name of the game is sediment delivery into the channel. We have some constrictions that slow down the passage of bedrock. Bedrock can't really squeeze through here, but once it is delivered, the channel is able to start moving it along. So once again, here's our look of fine sediment, and the features of it that are worth seeing is that there's a lot of distributed sources of fine sediment in this watershed, and there are a couple of very high delivery sources down in the lower watershed. And you can see this from going through this kind of an exercise. In coarse sediment, we see that there's some valley constrictions that hold back the sediment. It's a more complicated story. There are fairly limited sources of coarse sediment here. And the lower watershed is a source of coarse sandstone, which make those really big blocks, only to the extent that they're able to erode into older terrace deposits, like I showed you earlier. So really different styles of how the sediment moves down. The net result, when you add this all together, is an annual load of sediment here. And for those of you that can't see this, it's 2,200 tons per square kilometer per year. This is like an order of magnitude plus, even though it's a smaller watershed. And if we compare this to other studies, so out here is where Santa Paula Creek sits. Out here is where Issaquah Creek sits. So these are really different watersheds. They're really different in terms of their geology. They're really different in terms of their climatology. And as a result, they have very different flood flows, and they have incredibly different sediment delivery regimes. We see this expressed in particular in Santa Paula Creek by some pretty dramatic rates of channel incision. This is the lowermost 4 miles of the channel. These are different profiles, and I just call your attention to these areas. We've got incision here that's on the order of 20 to 30 feet through bedrock over a 60-year period. That's a lot of incision. That's a lot of variation. Up here, you'll also notice that incision is very much associated with the dam. And so there is a story here, or a lesson here,
about the consequences of putting human infrastructure in the path of a channel like this. A couple of quick air photos as we wrap up here, Santa Paula Creek. This is not incised. It's flowing all over its fan. It's been ditched a little bit through here, but not much. The town is just starting to grow up over on this side. In 2005, the town has completely grown up. You cannot have rivers spraying their sediment, their boulders, all over, you know, sort of Aunt Mabel's backyard. So the channel was ditched. It was straightened. And in fact, if we look at the 100-year floodplain in that lower area, we'll see that actually the Corps has done a great job of confining flows to a lower reach, which is very good if all you care about is flood control. But if you also have concerns for ecological function, fish habitat, which once upon a time they did not down here, but an endangered species of steelhead has been recognized as having standing even in Southern California. And so there is a new initiative that, were it ever to come to pass, would be many, many, many millions of dollars to try and undo some of the damage that has been wrought. So I will leave you with the thought that, you know, we live in a beautiful, benign, peaceful, riverine environment. But not every place is built that way. And it's well worth appreciating what we have and some of the degrees to which what you learn here can and cannot be transferred to wherever you may wind up going next. Thank you very much.